Tested Faisal bin Farhan in the capital Riyadh. In a joint presser after the talks, the two officials hailed steps by their countries to restore and enhance bilateral ties.
We are witnessing today that the relationship between the two countries is headed in the right direction. Both countries are willing to expand and enhance cooperation in all fields.
Today's meeting is a continuation of the steps taken to implement the agreements to resume the diplomatic ties, which represents a historic turning point of the two nations and the path of regional security.
The Saudi foreign minister said Tehran and Riyadh are determined to put into effect the terms of the agreements to rebuild ties. He also said the Saudi government welcomes a visit by the Iranian president to the kingdom. Bin Farhan had already presented an official invitation to Ebrahim Raisi during his visit to Tehran in June. That visit took place after Tehran and Riyadh agreed to mend ties through a deal brokered by China in March. The deal put an end to 7 years of strained bilateral relations. Iran's Ministry of Intelligence has issued a statement about Sunday's terror attack at a holy shrine in the southern city of Shiraz. The ministry says it has arrested the person playing the most pivotal role in providing logistics for the attack that killed two people. According to the statement, the detained person was directly linked to ringleaders of the Daesh terrorist group. The ministry drew similarities between the weekend deadly attack and the one that took place at the same holy site or holy shrine in Shiraz last year. It said the assailants in the two attacks were both Takfiri terrorists with Tajik nationalities. The ministry added that the first assault coincided with nationwide riots plotted by Iran's enemies, while the latter came as the anniversary of those riots is approaching. Iran's intelligence ministry noted that the U.S. is seeking to reactivate Daesh after the terrorist group was defeated by the resistance front in the West Asian region. 70 years ago, the United States, with the help of a British spy service, staged a coup against the democratic government of then Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, a bitter but vivid memory in the history of Iran. Farzaneh Ashurian has more.
Iran today in Tehran is named after Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, a familiar name among Iranian people, which is closely related to words such as oil, England, the US, and most importantly, coup.
With the efforts of the then Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, Iran's oil industry was nationalized in 1952. This meant putting an end to British control over the country's oil industry. The UK and the US made joint attempts to regain control over Iranian oil, but to no avail. Eventually, the British government severed its diplomatic relations with Iran. This hostility led to a plotted coup against Mossadegh in 1953.
The US and the UK feared that they would lose control over Iran's resources, especially oil, because Mossadegh had nationalized oil and had taken the power and the control of the oil industry in Iran away from the British and given it back to the Iranians.
The coup was orchestrated by the U.S. against the democratically elected government of Mossadegh under the excuse of the fear of Iran falling into the hands of communism and the Soviet Union during the Cold War era.
The U.S. was terrified at that time of communism. And so they thought Iran was going to join the communist, or their propaganda was that Iran was going to join the communist bloc, even though they knew Iran wouldn't, because Iran was trying to play a neutral game, a very, very non-aligned game.
The overthrow of Mossadegh was planned by the CIA, a plan which consisted of gaining the trust of Mossadegh's government, a trust which was broken by Washington later on.
The U.S. initially supported the nationalization of the Iranian oil industry to win the trust of the Iranian government. However, after participating in the coup, the U.S. sought its own domination over the country's oil resources. Trusting America was a mistake made by the Iranian government.
But the coup was just the beginning of America's open hostility with Iran.
The beginning of the hostility between Iran and America was certainly from the side of the American government itself.
The memory of the 1953 coup among Iranians is a bitter one, a reminder of imperialist intervention that may have sparked the Islamic Revolution some 20 years after. Farzaneh Ashurian, Tehran.
The United Nations says it will slash food aid to millions of Yemenis amid funding shortages. The World Food Programme warned that more than 4 million Yemenis will receive less food assistance in the coming months amid a deeper funding crisis that began in September. The UN Food Agency says it requires nearly $1 billion in funding for the next 6 months, but only 28% of the sum has been secured. The WFP also cut food aid for 13 million Yemenis by more than 50% in June last year. Yemen is suffering from the world's worst humanitarian crisis, which has been fueled by nearly 8 years of Saudi-led war and siege. Military chiefs of West Africa's main regional bloc have agreed on a date for possible military intervention in the coup-hit Niger. The defense chiefs of the 15-member ECOWAS say they are ready to act whenever an order is given. The alliance is also warning that it would not engage in endless dialogue with Niger's junta. This is while the bloc says it prefers a peaceful solution and that military action would be the last option. Niger has been in turmoil since late July when military officers deposed President Mohamed Bazoum. They've so far defied calls from the UN, ECOWAS and the West to return power to the president. The US, Japan and South Korea announced a security pledge to consult each other in moments of crisis as Washington seeks to counter Beijing's growing influence.
First, we're elevating our trilateral defense collaboration to deliver an Indo-Pacific region that includes launching annual multi-domain military exercises, bringing our trilateral defense cooperation to unprecedented levels. We're doubling down on information sharing, including on the DPRK's missile launches and cyber activities, strengthening our ballistic missile defense cooperation. And critically, we've all committed to swiftly consult with each other in response to threats to any one of our countries from whatever source it occurs. That means we'll have a hotline to share information and coordinate our responses whenever there is a crisis in the region or affecting any one of our countries. And today, we've reaffirmed our shared commitment to maintaining peace and stability in the Taiwan Straits and addressing economic coercion. We're going to continue to counter threats from the DPRK, including cryptocurrency money laundering to the tune of billions of dollars, potential arms transfer in support of Russia's brutal war against Ukraine. And together, we're going to stand up for international law, freedom of navigation, and the peaceful resolution of disputes in the South China Sea.
Biden made the remarks during a press conference after meeting with his South Korean counterpart and the Japanese Prime Minister at Camp David presidential retreat in the U.S. The South Korean and Japanese leaders also expressed their commitments to working together on various fields, including technology. Meanwhile, China has already slammed any kind of what it called bloc confrontation in the Indo-Pacific region.
The Asia-Pacific region is a promising land for peace and stability and cooperation and development and should not become a dueling ground for geopolitical rivalry. Attempts to form various exclusive groups and cliques and bring bloc confrontation in the Asia-Pacific region are unpopular and will definitely spark vigilance and opposition in the countries of the region.
Wenbin said no country should seek its own security at the expense of the security interests of others. He added that the international community will judge who is behind the escalations in the region. Tensions between the US-led bloc and China have been escalating recently over a series of issues, including Taiwan, territorial disputes in the South China Sea, and dealing with North Korea. The Parliament of the World's Religions is the world's largest interfaith conference, uniting hundreds of the world's major and minor spiritualities in one place. The gathering is a reminder of how religious feeling unites all of humanity and propels the globe towards higher ideals. Rami Mazari has more from Chicago.
Religious leaders from more than 200 different spiritualities and 80 different countries gathered in Chicago for the Parliament of the World's Religions, the largest interfaith conference in the world. Since 1893, the organization has brought together people of faith who are committed to justice, peace, and spiritual growth. A key conference was Faith Over Fear, Countering Anti-Muslim Discrimination, which aimed to connect, equip, and energize all people of faith for anti-racist mobilizations or in anticipation of a looming Islamophobic incident.
In the United States, which is where our focus is, it is, in some cases, it comes in waves, but as we're now facing another presidential campaign cycle, we're keeping our eyes and ears open because we expect that anti-Muslim hatred will become part of the conversation in the public square, perhaps even in some of the political campaigns themselves.
In Sweden and Denmark recently, the Holy Quran was burned and defaced in appalling and unnecessary provocations. And with their governments refusing to intervene, sparking protests worldwide. Activists noted that if someone hates Muslims, they likely hate many others as well.
Not only do studies show that people that hold anti-Muslim views also hold anti-Semitic views, also views about immigrants and refugees, black and brown communities. And so we believe that in addressing anti-Muslim discrimination and violence, we're making an inroads to help people address other forms of discrimination and racism, especially within the United States, where our history of religious intolerance and racism intersect for Muslims.
The parliament is held every 2 or 3 years in different cities around the world, and it helps build relationships between people who typically wouldn't cross paths, and that has lasting positive effects.
When it comes to so many things are different from Islam, one of our core beliefs is that Allah made different type of people, and he specifically asked Muslims to go learn from the kind of people he made. They are all equal in Allah's eyes. We all are. So I would feel if I would be doing injustice if I did not talk to these people and learn about them.
Attendees said that seeing the range of the world's religious practices in one place, from Abyssinians to Zoroastrianism, produces awe, respect, and the recognition of mankind's indivisible unity amid a splendid diversity.
The parliament is a reminder that faith isn't a barrier, but the inspiration for cooperation, and that humanity's collective global problems will be solved by people of faith continuing to work together. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Russia says it has destroyed Ukrainian drones targeting Moscow and its Black Sea fleet. The Russian Defense Ministry says one of the drones fell on a non-residential building in the capital's business district. Officials said it did not cause significant damage and no casualties were reported. The ministry also said its naval ships destroyed a remotely operated boat in the Black Sea. That was the second time this month that Ukraine has attempted to sink Russian vessels. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned last month that war was coming to Russia and that its symbolic centers and military bases were targets. The Kremlin says the escalated drone strikes have been mostly unsuccessful and look like acts of desperation. It says the attacks are motivated by Ukraine's failure to breach Russian lines during its counteroffensive to regain lost territory. The Italian government has been widely criticized after fuel prices reached its highest levels in more than a year.
Italy, August is the time when millions of people take their annual holidays. The large majority of the Italians travel to their favorite destinations with their cars. But this summer, Italians are grappling with record high fuel prices that may affect their programs, with the cost of petrol reaching a new record high for the 17th consecutive day this month.
Our lawmakers in that building over there, they are fine in their government cars paid by us citizens. Fuel costs more than €2 per litre today. This is pure madness. There is no reason for these hikes. It's just speculation.
According to official data, the price of fuel with standard quality reached €2.019 per litre on the highways earlier this week. Petrol price at some service stations has even reached €2.7 per litre. The last time when prices were so high was in July 2022, following the start of the war in Ukraine. Italy's main farmers association, Coldiretti, has warned that in a country like Italy, where almost 90% of the goods travel by road to reach the shelves, the increase in fuel prices will result in sharp spikes, over 30%, in the cost of fruit and vegetables. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The 15th BRICS Summit, which is going to be held in South Africa this month, is expected to make the global governance system fairer and counterbalance the dominance of Western countries, the executive director of the South Center said. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Tasnim News Agency, the event's agenda will be topped by efforts toward de-dollarization, or reducing the U.S. dollar's hegemony, and the expansion of the bloc, Carlos Maria Correa said. The BRICS group of major emerging economies, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, will hold its 15th Heads of State and Government Summit in Johannesburg between August 22nd to August 24th. The summit will be the first in-person BRICS gathering since the COVID-19 pandemic. Altogether, the BRICS nations account for more than 40% of the world population and about 26% of the global economy. Correa maintained, as Xinhua reported, one key issue for the BRICS to consider is global governance. There is a need to change the current system, which is unfair and asymmetric. In particular, the architecture of the financial system needs a major reform. Leaders are also expected to discuss the group's expansion by adding new members, including the admission criteria and the guiding principles. Correa stated, "Among my hopes is that the current BRICS group considers the incorporation of other countries. This will be very important because it will give volume to the BRICS group. Of course, major economies such as those of India, Brazil, and China are there, but if other countries can also be incorporated, the political dimension of the BRICS will be improved significantly." Meanwhile, Daily News Egypt wrote in this regard, "So far, over 20 countries have formally applied to become new BRICS members, including Iran, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Argentina, Egypt, Indonesia, and Ethiopia." Korea said the BRICS play an important role in counterbalancing the G7 and G20. They look for solutions that are aligned with the interests of the other developing countries. According to reports, Russian diplomat Roman Babushkin confirmed that BRICS is developing a new payment system to end reliance on the U.S. dollar. The new payment mechanism will use local currencies for cross-border transactions and mutual settlements among BRICS members. The development aligns with the changing global dynamics, and fosters the growth of the BRICS members' respective local currencies. He said, with over one-third of the world's GDP, a total population of around 3 billion people, and a strong desire of other states to join its activities, it is safe to say that BRICS has become an integral element of an evolving multipolar paradigm. According to CGTN, de-dollarization has been a buzzword for the past few months, with various discussions surrounding the dominance and decline of the dollar. Several countries have recently become increasingly worried about their reliance on the U.S. dollar. Amid decreasing foreign reserves and the increasing cost of the U.S. dollar due to rising interest rates, many central banks are looking for alternatives. Consequently, they actively explore other currencies to lessen their dependence on the dollar. This shift away from a single dominant global currency is called de-dollarization, which has started to cause ripples in the global economy. Besides economic factors, there are many underlying political reasons for this change, including U.S. policies and sanctions against many countries. If the trend continues, it could reshape the entire international trade and financial system. As Brazil's President Lula da Silva expressed in April this year, every night, he asks himself, why all countries have to base their trade on the dollar? Now, many countries and leaders are asking themselves the same question. Many countries are looking for currencies other than the dollar for trade. As the trend of de-dollarization gains momentum worldwide, Bolivia has become the third South American nation to adopt the Chinese yuan for trade settlement. In a report published in the Time magazine, the Minister of Economy and Public Finance of Bolivia, Marcelo Montenegro, said in a news conference, "We are already using the yuan. It's a reality and a good start. Banana, zinc, and wood manufacturing exporters are conducting transactions in yuan, as well as importers of vehicles and capital goods." It was also shared that between May and July of this year, Bolivia engaged in financial transactions totaling 278 million Chinese yuan, approximately $38.7 million, making up 10% of its foreign trade. Additionally, China has become Bolivia's second largest trade partner and a primary source of imports, and the bilateral cooperation between the two countries spans various sectors, including infrastructure, aerospace, information technology, and oil and gas development. Bolivia has now become part of a group of South American countries, including Brazil and Argentina, which have started using the yuan in their financial transactions. In Argentina, the government announced a plan earlier this year to use the yuan for paying imports from China. It also considered the possibility of using the Chinese currency to repay debts owed to the International Monetary Fund.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. Today is the tragic first of the month of Safar, the day when survivors of the massacre of the Prophet's progeny at Karbala were unjustly dragged to the court of the tyrant Yazid in Damascus. Let us contemplate today on the words of the Prophet's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, when she boldly told the tyrant Yazid about the illegitimacy of his rule. those who have helped you to become the head of the Muslim state have done a big disservice to Islam and will soon know what awaits them.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, not making a judgment while we are angry. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, dear friends, we are talking about not making a judgment while we are angry. It's interesting, overall, anger has been reprimanded in Islam. When we look at the various ethical and moral teachings that we have received via the infallible and immaculate imams, alayhim as-salam, we find that anger is one of the things that we are most reprimanded from. Now, of course, there are many keys to evil and there are many keys to sins, but many a time it has been said that one of the key keys of going down the path of evil and towards the path of sinning and even regret and remorse is anger. Now, of course, we really shouldn't do anything while we are angry. Of course, when an individual becomes angry, it is a sort of intoxication which comes about. It is this kind of rage that overwhelms an individual, and an individual cannot make correct decisions. Most of the time, they say things which they regret, highly regret sometimes. And they do actions which they also regret later on. So definitely anger is one of those things that at all costs we must try to avoid. But what's really interesting is that amongst this discussion of anger and controlling our temper and trying not to get frustrated to the point where we blow up, one of the things that is discussed is to not make judgments while we are angry. Welcome back, dear friends. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about anger. but more specifically, we are talking about not making judgments while we are angry. So we had said in the previous segment that we really have to be careful when we're angry. First and foremost, we need to try to not become angry. That is the first step. Now, anger in itself cannot be said to be something that is bad, because it is this anger which is sourced in this feeling of defense sometimes. Because really, when one wants to defend themselves, is that they become angry. So, you know, somebody says something to you, you get angry because you want to defend yourself, right? Or somebody tries to steal something from you, you become angry. You're trying to defend yourself. Now, there's different ways that this happens, right? You try to defend yourself, and in that defense, you have to become quote-unquote angry in order to have the courage to be able to, you know, defend yourself. So anger in that sense is good, but anger when it is out of control, when it's not in its due place, when it is illegitimate to be angry in a certain situation, then of course it has been highly prohibited for us to become angry. You know, we can't just become angry at our spouses, become angry at our friends, become angry at our children, right? But anyways, we're talking about judgment, and we're going to just close off the segment at this thing is, well, when you are in the intoxication of anger and you're not doing it for the right reasons, then, of course, this intoxication of anger will lead you to make bad decisions and, of course, also to make bad judgment calls. And so most definitely, if nothing else, when you're angry, definitely, definitely don't make a judgment. Don't make judgment calls because you will most probably make a mistake. And again, an integral part in our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Cuba.
Part 4.
In the 3 years that followed the revolution, many Cubans who profited from Batista's policies and U.S. companies left Cuba for Miami in the U.S. Cuban expats were the perfect choice to perform the play against their country. The first step in the operation against Cuba was to destabilize the economic routes of the country. CIA-trained groups planted a bomb in the Belgian steamship La Courbe. Apparently, it was transferring weapons to Cuba. The bomb blast claimed the lives of 100 civilians, and many more were injured. Exiled Cuban pilots flying CIA aircraft and bombing Havana Airport or setting sugar plantations on fire and killing civilians were other steps in the operation. Yet none of the CIA's operations led to the overthrow of Castro. As a result, the White House's plots became more extreme. And finally, a plan for an all-out military offensive by hundreds of militia forces was implemented. The Bay of Pigs operation was also known as Zapata operation. To perform the operation, hundreds of Cuban exiles in the U.S. were trained by CIA operatives in Nicaragua to overthrow Cuba's revolutionary government. On the 15th of April, 1961, 8 American B-26 bombers flown by exiled pilots attacked the Cuban Air Force and killed citizens.
The same line is followed at a dramatic meeting of the United Nations General Assembly's Political Committee by Cuban Foreign Minister Raúl Roa, charging his nation has been invaded by what he terms mercenaries from Guatemala and Florida. Quickly, forcefully, the charges are denied. Chief U.S. Delegate Adlai E. Stevenson.
These charges are totally false, and I deny them categorically.
Two days later, CIA-backed forces entered the Bay of Pigs on the southwestern coast of Cuba. They had not penetrated too far when they met heavy defense from Cuba's military.
From the sea and by parachute, the rebels have struck along the coast within 90 miles of Havana. Initial accounts of the fighting sketchy, but strafing and bombing of communications and military targets reported with heavy casualties.
Castro came to the battleground himself to take control of the operation. More than 1,400 Cuban exiles took part in the Bay of Pigs invasion, some of whom were killed and many more were arrested and imprisoned. Cuba managed to overpower the invaders. This defeat resulted in the embarrassment of the U.S. and rise in the popularity of Castro in Cuba and around the world. The Americans saw Fidel as their enemy. The White House concluded that Fidel Castro must be eliminated so that the revolution will unravel and fall apart. Castro's assassination was in fact an assassination of Cuba's revolution. The CIA made several attempts to kill Fidel, and the most famous one was Operation Mongoose, in which they aimed to kill Castro by slipping an explosive cigar in his supply. Yet, none of these plots were successful. The issue became so crucial and serious for the Americans that they even invested in childish ideas. Some of their plots did not at murdering him, but at distorting his image. For example, one of them involved using thallium salts to destroy Castro's famous beard. But even in doing this, they were unsuccessful. Shortly after, U-2 reconnaissance aircraft, which flew over Cuba 24/7, captured footage that shocked the White House. It seemed that in a secret agreement, the Soviet Union had positioned its missiles in Cuba. Now, it was Cuba that was a threat to America. This news was given to the American public on October the 22nd, 1962, by President John F. Kennedy.
The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
all ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace. He has an opportunity now to move back from the abyss of destruction. And our history, unlike that of the Soviets since the end of World War II, demonstrates that we have no desire to dominate or conquer any other nation.
After long discussions, arguments, and correspondence between the Soviet Union and the United States, Khrushchev finally agreed to remove the missiles in exchange for America's halting its operations against Cuba and also the evacuation of American missiles from Turkey. The Cuban Missile Crisis could have ultimately led to an atomic war between the two powers, but luckily it did not happen. But even this did not prevent the Americans from hostility towards Cuba. The U.S. hostility continued in the years that followed. At the turn of the century, Fidel Castro was getting ready to retire from politics. After an operation due to colon cancer, he stepped down from power in 2006 and was replaced by his brother Raul. The leader of the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro, passed away on November the 25th, 2006, at the age of 90. During his life as head of the revolution, he struggled against 10 U.S. presidents. During Obama's administration, attempts were made to establish embassies in the two countries. But the economic and political pressure against Cuba was not eased. Perhaps the new generations of Cubans who had not witnessed the revolution were hopeful that Obama's promises will lead to a different future for them and they can experience living in the glamorous world that the Americans call the free world. But this did not materialize in Obama's administration, and the new U.S. president, who is much like the Las Vegas casino owners, fulfilled these wishes in a different way. For the occupants of the White House, only one Cuba was good. Batista's Cuba.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to a survey, a clear majority of investors anticipate that the U.S. economy will slip into recession by the end of 2024. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. According to Moody's Analytics, the typical American household spent $709 more in July than they did 2 years ago to buy the same goods and services. That figure underscores the cumulative impact of high inflation has had on consumer finances, even as price growth has cooled considerably in recent months. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, wrote in a post on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, "High inflation of the past 2 years has done lots of economic damage." Mark Zandi told CNN in an email on Friday, 11th of August, "Most of that increase in spending is driven by housing costs, which have surged." He added that families are also spending more at the grocery store, on buying, maintaining and insuring vehicles, and on recreational services. Of course, paychecks have also grown over the past 2 years, but not by as much as the cost of living. Even though prices have soared, real earnings, which adjust for inflation, are stuck at late 2019 levels. Mark Zandi said, "Real earnings remain below what they would have been if not for the pandemic and the Russia-Ukraine war, which is weighing on the collective psyche." The latest news is that wages are finally starting to outpace inflation and consumer price growth has eased significantly, so much so that many investors are betting the Federal Reserve is done raising interest rates. Looking at just the last year, Zandi calculates that the typical household spent $202 more this July than they did a year ago to buy the same goods and services. That's significant, but it's still below the peak of $536 for this year, year-over-year metric. A record hit back in June of 2022, when gas prices spiked above $5 a gallon for the first time. According to a government report released on Wednesday, 9th of August, consumer prices increased by a cooler-than-expected 3.2% in July, compared to a year ago. Even though that was slightly higher than the annual inflation rate in June, most of the impact was driven by calendar effects. Bank of America economists wrote in a note to clients on Thursday, 10th of August, "In sum, the report was encouraging. They wouldn't be surprised to see another soft inflation reading in August, although month-over-month inflation readings are still likely to be bumpy." Bank of America economists said they believe that the current disinflation is not a head fake. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to new consumer price data released on Thursday, 10th of August, by the Labor Department, inflation ticked up to 3.2% year over year in July and 0.2% from June alone. This marks the first increase after 13 months of falling inflation, but that doesn't necessarily mean inflation is about to come roaring back. The so-called Core Consumer Price Index, or CPI, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, dropped slightly from 4.8% year-over-year in June to 4.7% year-over-year in July. The CPI, the Consumer Price Index, is one of several economic indicators that the Federal Reserve is watching as it weighs whether to hike interest rates again at its September meeting. While inflation has plummeted from its 9.1% year-over-year peak last June, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Jerome Powell told reporters recently there's still a long way to go before inflation returns to its 2% target. New York Federal Reserve Bank President John Williams recently said a September interest rate hike is an open question, while Federal Reserve Governor Michelle Bowman said recently that it will likely be needed. Economists said stubbornly high housing costs are perhaps the biggest barrier to bringing down inflation and interest rates. Eugenio Alemán, chief economist at Raymond James, said, "This better inflation reading does not change our view that the Federal Reserve is going to increase the federal funds rate at least once more before the end of this year." Eugenio Alemán added, "In order for this to change, there would need to be a strong decoupling between headline inflation and core inflation. But for that, we need a big slowdown in shelter costs, which we have been expecting for several months and has still failed to show up. High interest rates have been driving up the cost of mortgages, car ownership and balance-carrying credit cards. Consumer debt ballooned $17.9 billion from May to June, and American credit card balances surpassed $1 trillion. The dual burden of high prices and interest rates has soured some Americans' economic outlook. Polling conducted recently by The Economist by YouGov found half of Americans think official inflation statistics understate the economic strain. 39% of the American public anticipate inflation would be higher in 6 months' time. The Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a survey, a clear majority of investors anticipate that the US economy will slip into recession by the end of 2024. The survey was conducted from 31st of July to 4th of August and involved 410 investors. The latest Markets Live Pulse survey, a weekly investor survey asking questions about different elements of financial markets, said nearly two-thirds of the 410 respondents anticipate a downturn in the world's biggest economy by the end of next year. The survey showed a minority of 20% of respondents have even seen a slump in 2023. Recently, ratings agency Moody's downgraded the credit ratings of 10 U.S. banks and warned of possible cuts to more lenders. Moody's announcement came after a ratings firm, Fitch, downgraded U.S. government debt rating in early August. Morgan Stanley's Michael Wilson told Bloomberg that Fitch Ratings' downgrade of U.S. government debt and the ensuing sell-off in the bond market suggest that investors should be ready for potential disappointment on economic and earnings growth.
Midstream.
On the 34th day, the war stopped. And on this day, the Lebanese citizens regained the scene of liberation in the year 2000, when the people of the south from the displaced villages began to return to their homes, despite the Israeli air and sea blockade and the continued presence of the occupation soldiers in some parts of the border villages. It is the victory of August 14 after a 33-day Lebanese war with the Zionist entity. This victory laid the foundations for new rules of engagement and overturned the equations of the Israeli entity and even the international equations in the region. The entity began to calculate the cost of engaging with the resistance 1,000 times before any step further. And since that aggression in 2006, the entity did not dare to repeat that experience. No matter how different the Zionist prime ministers and officials were, they all agreed on one thing. Hezbollah, the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, is a grand danger to their existence, and they cannot think of committing the slightest foolishness against it. This victory gave great motivation and hope to all the resistance movements in the region and made them realize that the myth of the indomitable Israeli occupation army is just nonsense and a mere illusion. So the Israeli entity became anxious. In addition to its great fear of Hezbollah, its illegal colonial settlers were then worried of all the liberation movements and factions in the region besides the already existing Palestinian resistance. The Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said in his last speech on the occasion of the 17th anniversary of the victory of July 2006 that the victory of July 2006 put the Israeli enemy along with its entity on the line of descent and the line of decline. What Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said about the July victory and its relationship to the Israeli line of decline leads us to shed light on the beginning of this line since the withdrawal from Lebanon in the year 2000, which lies between two promises: the Balfour Declaration and the promise of the hereafter. The victory of 2000 opened the path to the Israeli decline that established all the victories of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine. In the same year, the second Palestinian intifada, known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada, began, one of the most important results of which was the dismantling of the Israeli settlement project in the Gaza Strip and the withdrawal of the Israeli army from it in 2005 due to the continuous strikes of the Palestinian resistance. The pivot point in the line of Israeli decline was the July 2006 war, known to the Zionist entity as the Second Lebanon War, and recognized by it as a clear military defeat. After that, the Palestinian resistance wars began since 2008 until the last battle, dubbed Revenge of the Free, passing through the Sword of Al-Quds and others, which came in the context of the Israeli decline. Welcome to the Mideast Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. The free peoples of the world, along with the supporters of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, commemorated the 17th anniversary of the victory of the Mujahideen of Hezbollah over the Israeli entity in the aggression that the latter began on July 12, 2006, which ended forcibly with humiliation of the entity on August 14. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament in the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah. A pleasure to have you along with us on this special day, Dr. Moussaoui. Now, the Lebanese prepare every year on August 14 to revive the occasion of the victory against the Zionist entity in 2006, which has become a defining point in their history as a people, in the history of the resistance, in the history of the peoples of the region, and in the history also of the Israeli entity and its settlers. How do you recall August 14, 2006?
Well, thank you for giving the opportunity. And yes, this is a very important time and occasion that we should always commemorate, we should always remember. And if you ask any Lebanese, not only any Lebanese, any free human spirit, any free human soul, any Arab, any Muslim, any revolutionary, any someone who seeks freedom and dignity, he will tell you definitely, or they'll tell you definitely, this is a period of dignity, of glory, of freedom, of independence. People long all of their life to find a meaning for their life, actually, because, I mean, life without a meaning is lifeless. So when the resistance emerged victorious after this very important battle against the Israeli occupation, against the Israeli colonization, against the world imperialism, because when we talk about Israel here, we're not talking about an isolated phenomenon, we're not talking about an isolated state, we're talking about a state that all of the support from the Western hegemonic world pour into it in order to supply it with all high-tech weaponries, with all, if you want, political immunity, because the veto is always there at the Security Council to torpedo any attempt to condemn Israel, or let alone to put sanctions or whatever. So when we commemorate this time, when we commemorate this occasion, it gives us a pride, it gives us dignity, it gives us also the will and the determination and the resolve to continue our struggle against the occupiers, against the expansionists, against the imperialists, and against this inhumane Western system.
Well, Dr. Moussaoui, the victory of July 2006 is a historical turning point between the beginning and the end of the so-called Israel. It's a central station that separated the stages of Israeli rise and the Israeli decline, and an essential history between two promises, the false Balfour Declaration or promise and the true promise of the hereafter, which you are just explaining right now, and the decline of the actual entity. Does the Israeli entity's leaders know that they are on a path